Look alive, EOB Mafia. It's time for another action-packed installment of Evolution of Brand. I'm Jason Sircone, and today on episode 139, I'm sharing the mic with branding and consumer packaging dynamo Michael Keplinger for a powerful conversation about making your brand stand out in a competitive market. As we tap into the evolution of Michael's brand today, we'll be discussing why you need to see and build your brand through the eyes of your consumer, barriers that exist for brands as they look to make a lasting impression in their niche, how brand advertising has evolved over the years, and how big brands continue to line up against smaller brands willing to take more risks. All of this and much, much more is ready and waiting for you on episode 139 of Evolution of Brand, right after a quick word from yours truly. You know, we talk a lot about thought leadership and authority status here on Evolution of Brand, and the reason for that is the guests I've had the privilege of connecting with focus on this each and every day. And I guarantee you, if you ask any of them if that status has made a difference in everything they do, the answer you'd receive would be an emphatic hell yes across the board. Do you want to establish authority and become a thought leader in your niche? Then it's time for us to connect. I want to teach you the best approach I know for attracting new clients, increasing your profits, expanding your network, and achieving game-changing authority status. It's time for your brand to go from unknown to undeniable. Visit enhanceyourauthority.com today to get started. Michael Keplinger, welcome to Evolution of Brands. Say hello to the EOB Mafia and share a time that you listened to yourself instead of what others told you was right, and it led to a major accomplishment.
Hello, everyone. And Jason, thanks for having me on here. So quite my opening question, when I didn't listen, right? This was almost 25 years ago, really, when I got my start in entrepreneurism. And I was an engineer, computer engineer, in some golden handcuffs. And it was a hard salary to give up, but to quit that and move in and launch our brand, which to capitalize on some opportunity in the marketplace, really required to be all in, to just go and be fast and take advantage of the opportunity. And it was, I remember being a scary time, and my wife and family and everyone, it just thought it was the dumbest idea ever. But you know what? We just jumped all in. And I guess, as they say, the rest is history. I haven't had a job in 22 years.
All paid off in the end. And here you are. And it's great to have you here, Michael. Really looking forward to this conversation with you today. I'm glad you could take the time to join me. We are going to dive deep into your domain and your forte, consumer product strategy, and we'll mix in some brand communication talk as well. So definitely a lot to unpack. But before we dive into all of that with you today, Michael, take a moment to tell the Mafia who you are and how you forged your path to success.
I think a good story, as brands need to do, kind of need to lead with the punchline sometimes, like a difference from a joke. But where I am today, and I can kind of give some background of how we got there, but we own, aside from some brands, Smash Brand is a consumer packaging design agency. We're quite unique in our approach. We work with small, mid-sized brands, typically those challenger brands, much like a lot of your audience, are really trying to get an edge and trying to get a product out there that's successful. And so we have a very data-driven scientific approach that really maps what's going on inside a consumer's head when they make those decisions, and translate that to actionable insights along the way to iterate to something. When you put that on the shelf, you know it's going to work. Mm-hmm. So that's what we do at Smash Brand. I guess I started the story 22 years ago. My business partner and I, same business partner for all those years, through a number of businesses, launched our own consumer product. It was in the sports supplement space. And just over the years of owning brands, finding out what works, and eventually launching Smash Brand and starting to do some of that work for clients as well, especially in that initial brand building phase and that part that is extremely strategic of getting it right, which amplifies everything you do later on the shelf, marketing, things like this. It's almost like a force multiplier of everything that you could put out there. We just get so much fun and excitement of that. So we own a few of our own brands, but the bulk of our work is helping other brands do the same.
What were some of the big lessons that you guys learned in launching that first product that you've been able to apply to everything that you're doing today?
Yeah, when you're talking in the course of decades through that so much technology shift, as everybody knows, it is not even the same marketplace. And I think, for example, back then our model was really the wholesale, the traditional wholesale distribution model. We made products, we marketed, we drove demand to the stores where those products were, and we used distributors and supply chains to kind of get them out there. It's not that that is dead today, but what didn't exist back then was all the e-commerce, all the competition, all those barriers, and so many more products on the shelf. And so I think through trial and error, really, of you stick with what you know, you do it, and you just slowly over time find that one thing isn't working. And I think that's really the inception of what we do at Smashbrand and what we do for our clients is really pioneering how we approach this differently. And I would say, like, fast forward today, our whole kind of philosophy revolves around really understanding what has changed in how consumers shop and how we respond to advertisements or the lack thereof, and really how that actually translates to getting in there. And I think that even today, there's so many brands that don't really spend that time to figure that out and do that properly. And it really can make or break the success of any brand.
There's no question the internet has shifted the way that we shop for pretty much everything these days. Are you seeing with either the brands that you work with or just from your general observations and watching how the market has shifted and fluctuated over the years, are you seeing any parallels to how things were when you first broke in, when the internet wasn't as dominant? Are there any brands that are really understanding that if you have both sides of this in play, you can give yourself a leg up?
Yeah, many of our clients, and you know, depending on some of the audience that have direct to consumer brands, seems to be all the trend, right? Everybody's like, I'll just cut out the middleman, I'll go direct to consumer. 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, really large algorithm update and rules around advertising on Facebook. The game is changing, right? And there's at the same time that there's more competitors. And those brands are more sophisticated in using these direct-to-consumer things. Essentially, what it drives up for the brands is that customer acquisition cost. And you have a lot of brands that you almost need to be that unicorn to be successful in this single model. And so the shift where it's like, forget about the store, nobody shops anymore, it's all about online. The trend that I see happening now is kind of back the other way. It's not to say that one is better than the other, but I think a brand needs to think about omni strategy pretty intently. And not only that, but when you start to market that way, that one influences the other. You know, you learn about a product online, maybe through direct communication channel, direct to consumer channels, but they're not quite ready. And we all know about those funnels you're building, but then you go in the store and there it is, and you've actually have that leg up on the consumers. And so there's a lot to contend with of like measuring, which is more quantifiable on the online space, but then when you're in a store, it less so. And so that is, I think, the shift back towards, in particular, like food products and drugstore products and these kind of low dollar amount products that essentially I don't think are ever going to be bought exclusively or primarily online.
What I've noticed is that when you can build an experience, or when you're with a brand, or giving your loyalty to a brand, when you can feel the same way from their digital presence to how it is when you interact with someone in their store or at their brick and mortar business, the loyalty to me, I feel like I can gravitate to that brand and trust them so much more because I'm not being told one story on the internet and then another when I'm in front of them, or vice versa. So to have that parallel between both sides, as we said before, it definitely does give you a leg up, but I see it as a great way to build brand loyalty and really keep people on your side, and especially in this competitive market where so many new brands are popping up almost daily.
I don't disagree at all. I think everything that you said, you overlay onto like what category do I even operate in? Like what product do I operate in? And you've got, you know, take on the extreme end, you've got brands of cars, right? So you buy a car, you own that for 4 years, or you've got a brand of mayonnaise and you might buy one brand 1 week and then you have a big barbecue party and it's all gone. You go back and like, oh, this, I'm gonna try this brand, let's see what the flavor is. So it's about understanding how in that particular space, like how vested consumers are in that decision-making process. Is it a whim decision? Am I just deciding rather quickly? Or is it something like an Apple product that is extremely experiential? You go home and the unboxing experience, there's tons of YouTube videos on people showing. And so those different pieces are all the aspects about how your brand gets developed and in the consumer's mind. You take it home, the experience that I have, if it's just a kind of a throwaway thing, then consumers care a lot about other things like, are you using too much packaging? Or what do you do with a little bit of your profits or something along those lines? And so what I always recommend for brands is to think about, I'm interested in this, say, category, and everyone has choices, like a cars, going back to the cars, I might be looking at Tesla, but now there's all these other electric vehicles on the market. And so you weigh these different things and how you can fit in and be memorable. And sometimes that memory is the experience that they have later. You want them to buy it again, or it's a social type brand where they're going to tell all their friends about it. Going back to the mayonnaise, my friends don't tell me about mayonnaise, right? So, so you have to kind of connect with that consumer in a different way. And in that case, because it's a split decision at the grocery store, typically, what you want to be is more distinctive in the visual way you stand out. Can you be the funny shaped bottle, right, that it comes in, or using colors that and this is where a lot of what we do at Smashbrand of testing these things and trying to see what works. Like, you can push it too far and someone won't look at it because they no longer think that it's a mayonnaise bottle. So one, do I know what I'm looking at? And then second, can I stand out? Can I grab that attention on the shelf? And you can kind of translate what I'm saying inside of a store to wherever you are in your brand of grabbing that attention and just plugging in and looking really intently at what competitors are doing and understanding how those different kind of stages of that buyer journey fits into it all.
See, me and my friends, we talk about mayonnaise all the time.
Do you? Okay.
Oh, well, yeah. It's riveting conversation.
You like to make some aioli? I guess that's the new
sexy mayonnaise, right? Like, I'm seeing more and more of that on shelves. It's funny because that used to be one of those things. It's almost like, I mean, this is going so off the subject of where we're going today, but it's just a funny parallel. You think about back in the day, Red Lobster biscuits were like the greatest thing ever. And you'd look forward to going to Red Lobster of all places because they had these biscuits and I remember we used to try to take them out of there, like in our hats and stuff. They were that good.
Yeah.
And now you just buy them at the store. It's not as special. So
yeah, totally.
now you have aioli at a restaurant. I think, hey, whatever. I can get this anytime I want. So like,
I mean, talk about how you make something boring like mayonnaise sound amazing. Just call it aioli, right?
Yeah. Well, I think that's, you know, all of the rebrand geniuses in the world. You got to make these things that have lost their treads. How are you going to get them back on track? Give it a sexy name and just completely rebrand it. And all of a sudden, it's something brand new that we've never had before. But I digress.
It's not even that far of a digression. So much of the innovation is, I'm a kind of believer of people shouldn't hold their ideas tight because I don't think there's that many original ideas. And a lot of them are mashups, right? Like the aioli it's been around forever. We had a client a couple of years ago that was trying to reinvent applesauce for adults as like an alternative to afternoon snacking, like kind of tired of yogurts and things like this, but still want a healthy snack. But you kind of like, do you think of a snack for you as an adult, applesauce? So he had to reinvent that and like, how do you make adults actually think that this isn't for grandmas and their kids?
Right. Did I see that on Shark Tank?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm forgetting the name now, but I remember
Sanaya.
Yeah, I remember that. Now.
Yeah. Good memory. Right? Yeah. She's an amazing woman. She was from. She grew up in the U.S., but I think she was born in an early part of her life in Jamaica, and it was so common there that they would actually make so much fruit and everything, and they would mix all these exotic flavors together. So that was her jam, so to speak.
That's nice. That's sort of an inadvertent pun, but I don't care.
I thought about that too, but
5 years old, 20 years old, 42 years old as I am, as we sit and record today, I'll eat applesauce all day, any day, and not care at all. I love applesauce.
Touche. It's good. I got 3 kids, so I'm always eating the leftover applesauce.
There you go. Yeah. My daughter was big on it when she was younger too. So it's definitely got some legs, that food, regardless of how old you are. Michael, as I was getting ready for our conversation today, I discovered that your approach is that you look at everything from the eyes of the consumer. Personally, I am a firm believer in this approach as well. How did things change for you when you adopted this philosophy into everything that you were doing and put it into play with your brand and all the client brands that you're working with as well?
I would say that every client we work with, which is a new product that's going on the shelf. It's funny too, because they'll show up, a lot of them show up and they're like, this huge brand story and this is what we stand for and all these things. But and it's not that those things aren't important. They are, but they are in particular in a store shelf for a lot of product. Take your typical grocery store. There's so many products in there. And we as people like variety. We like to try and taste new things. And by and large, it's not that we saw an advertisement and we're like going to the store looking for this product. That happens too. But the number one thing that happens is that people see it. They encounter it on the shelf. And for whatever that brand decided to put on that package, it enticed them to put it in their cart and go buy it. And I bring that up because the old way, and I'm actually writing a book on this because it is such a shift in how we think about this. The old, you know, the Don Draper days where it was like an advertisement, there weren't that many brands and they got this beautiful story that connects with you emotionally to go out there and like, oh God, yes, I need that product. And they go to the store and get it. And that's how marketing was done. It was more of a push strategy. You get this brand awareness, go to the store and get it. But today, getting back to that kind of full circle on that technology is, that's not how we shop today. We've got our Facebook feeds, Instagram feeds, TikToks. It is so much information going on that our brains are experts at kind of sifting that stuff away. We don't pay attention to it. We're not interested in it. We don't have enough bandwidth for it. And so we don't look at it. And so it gets back to what I said. And so coming to answer your question, it's all about understanding how they shop. And I've been talking a lot about like grocery products and things that are on the shelf. You can translate this to, and I don't care if it's like the car where it's like months long, but the key is understanding how we shop. And so going as the example in the grocery store, we can talk about mayonnaise. We've started there. I'm walking down the aisle. I ran out of mayonnaise because we just had an aioli party and I need some new stuff. So before I get to that aisle, so first of all, unlike the Don Drapers where they create this mood and this context that I call it, right? So they're setting the stage. Well, in the grocery store, at a store shelf, that's your stage. As a brand, you don't have any control over what the setting is like. Your product is just on the shelf. But the consumer shows up with a lot going on in their head. Do they think, in the case of mayonnaise, they're all the same? They all kind of do the same thing. I've tried more than one. They're not that different. So I'm not that vested in looking at this. Whereas in a pet food, and we're working on a dog food brand here, where we know that it's been in the news a lot. There's been a lot of recalls on food. There's a pretty mega trend in human food and humanization of pets. And so we think about that. Like, oh, I want better food for myself. So I also want better food for my dog, but I can't trust my brands and all these things. So this is what the consumer shows up with. And so that buyer's journey in the mayonnaise is maybe 5 seconds. And in the pet food, they're going to flip it over. They're going to look at the ingredient panel. And so you think about how they shop, what they think of. You anticipate their objections or whatever information they're showing up in that buying experience. And when you have that, when you're armed with that, you can actually design and plan around that. And so that's what we do at Smash Brand. We make a hypothesis for what they're thinking about. We test it and we get to, and they're like, oh, what's confusing? And we kind of make it more clear. We pull these kind of different messages out. And ultimately, at the end of the day, you get to a product where they're like, no objections. It gave me all the information that I needed in the right order. And your product feels like the absolute perfect choice for them. That is completely different to how we traditionally have built brands.
I always love looking back on old time advertisements from 100 years ago, some even beyond that. And when you look at them, it wasn't this, you know, like now it's how many times, you know, let's flash boobs in your face. Let's do this. Let's do that. Like everything's got to be impactful. Boom, bang. You got to grab somebody's attention in like half a second. Back then it was slower. It asked you, please kindly invest in our product. And when you look at them, many of those ads had this story along with it. Again, totally different times, because now, as you said, we have conditioned ourselves to filter out so much of this stuff because we're seeing so much of this stuff. on every single platform every single day, we have to have some way to calibrate what we actually would need in our lives versus something that's just getting thrown in front of us. And we don't have that much time to interact like we did, let's say, 100 years ago when the ads weren't as plentiful and you could actually look at it and almost learn pretty much everything you needed to know before you got on the horse and buggy and went to the store or whatever, wherever you went to grab what you needed. It's just interesting to me how far we've come and how quickly the mindset shift has gone from give everybody everything they need to grab their attention in 2 to 3 seconds, or you're going to lose them because they're on to the next thing.
Yeah. On top of how we kind of filter all those ads away, we also have 5 times as many choices.
Absolutely.
So, so if you got a story to tell, like you said, like we did in the past, by the time you got to stage three, there's 4 other brands vying for you because the Facebook algorithm told all the other brands that you like this kind of stuff.
Exactly. My God, I was looking for a smartwatch. I wasn't even looking for a smartwatch. I just saw one that I thought looked really cool because I'm not big on the Apple Watch. Like personally, like I don't feel like I'm Penny from Inspector Gadget where I need the watch, or Dick Tracy, probably more mainstream, but I wanted one that looked like a technical, like a real nice looking watch. Boy, you find one of those and you're going to learn there are a lot of them out there because I got served up with ads all day, every day for like 2 weeks. And yeah, it was just overkill to the point where I was like, I don't even want this watch now. How the hell do I get these ads out of my legs? And now I'm blocking ads and stuff. It's crazy. But yeah, I mean, that's the world we're living in now. And it's just, it's a much quicker approach. And to some degree, I guess that's very convenient to some. I mean, again, if you were really in the market for something, for an algorithm to start feeding you these suggestions, if you really are in buying mode, it can be helpful. But if you're just browsing, it's like the person that comes up and asks for help and you say, no, I'm just looking. And then they just stay there in your ear and keep asking you the same question.
Yeah. Well, some brands, they just, to get the consumer there requires some education. Those are even more challenging because you were talking about the smartwatches and the first brand that marketed to you or looking at, their advertising dollars were educating you. And then the algorithms kick in and these other brands come and kind of serve you up later and down the funnel, right? It didn't sound like you ended up, it sounded like you didn't end up buying one because it became overwhelmed with choice. There it is.
Nope. Wrist is still clean. Yep.
But that's, those are the challenges that you have to educate. You have to jump in there and be there at the right time to close that sale.
Absolutely. Every brand does have a story to tell, which is something that we highlight a lot here in Evolution of Brand. It's just how you tell it and how you can strike that first chord with somebody where they can hear what you have to say. They can resonate with your message. That starts to establish the trust that they need to take the next step, to come to the store, to go to your website, to make that initial purchase and get the ball rolling. So whether it's mayonnaise, a smartwatch, a car, a product or service of any kind, if you have a good story to tell, you have the capability to tell it now. It's just got to be done in a much more direct and honestly, much faster way. Because again, we are just in that constant defense mechanism of pushing out ads as quickly as possible to get to what we think we really want to see. It's a strange back and forth and give and take that we have with these social networks and with the internet as a whole, but gives us something to talk about on a podcast, right?
It does. You kind of made me think of something when you were mentioning how we put that forward. And certainly every successful brand is going to need to be different and differentiate. Mm-hmm. But different, like being singularly differentiated is really challenging to get these days. So usually how I think about it is maybe you're not the only one that does your thing, but you're the only one that does these 3 things. And when you combine them together, that creates this kind of distinctiveness that makes you who you are as a brand. But also, and you touched on this too, of I think brands try to be too many things and they're better served being a lot more focused. And so you find your lead thing and you know, maybe if you're lucky, you're the only one that does that lead thing. And if you're not, then this plus this other secondary thing make you distinctly different. And sometimes it's not about product attribute, but it's more about something that you do. Like I think of brands like Tom's Shoes. Their shoes were pretty ordinary, but it was more their cause. And then everyone tried to do that, but it only works the first time, really, right?
Well, and I think there's a big element. I mean, of course, the differentiation is big, but if you can get very singular in what you offer, then you can become the expert in that field or in that space or be the authority that people turn to. And you can open up a lot of doors when you do that. But yeah, when you try to go from being the scalpel to the Swiss Army knife, you probably more than likely bring on more headaches than you're ready for, just because it's FOMO, right? Like, that's how I look at it. Like, I feel like, I'm missing out on this segment of the market, of the audience, because I'm only specialized here. I think we all internally battle with that as we're building our business. I know I've had this conversation in my mind many times. There's other skills that I could be taking advantage of, but if I go down that road, it's pulling away from where my focus needs to be. And I think that's how all brands should be looking at it, is what can we specialize in that's really going to put us on the map, and we can make a name for ourselves in this space, because the right people are going to find us and they're going to trust us, therefore do business with us.
Couldn't agree more. Be more singular and narrow in that position too.
Michael, where do you see other brands falling short when it comes to making that important first impression with consumers?
A recurring theme that I think I see a lot is, we're working with a client, like, tell me about your brand. And they'll list all these things that sound really, that they think are special, and to me sound rather ordinary. And I know it's like kind of coming off the heels of that discussion we just had, but it really is so important, like, to really focus on what makes you special and get that in there. And then actually articulate that into, like, the brand story, like the voice, and bring life to it and connect it to the human side of what you're doing and how those products or services or whatever it is fits into people's lives. A huge mistake is to just go rather quickly on the branding and what you stand for. And because typically what happens is when you don't put that thought in there, then you're actually following your consumer's lead, because, you know, while it is true, I truly, truly believe that your brand is what your customers say you are. It's their impression of you. That is a fact. But brands that aren't purposeful about shaping that perception kind of land up in a kind of a boring place, like a not very special place, because they're trying to pander to, oh, he said this about me, we're this, and we focus on that. And so I think that really having that purpose and of who you, what you want to stand for. And you know, I can use the example of the work that we do too. So we're going to begin a project like this. We're going to begin working with a brand of really deciding what perceptions we want consumers to take from us. And I think of it like this, it's human nature to judge things, right? We need to make sense of things rather quickly, especially when there's a lot of things. And so, like, what is this, and how do I react to it? And so when we talk about whether a brand has a website or visuals that they use or the associations that they make, so we relate everything that we know to things that are familiar to us. And so we create these associations. And I think that a brand is purposeful about how they want to be seen, what they want to stand for, what their brand, what their product or service stands for, can actually think about how they can shape those perceptions. They put those different kind of associations in front of consumers. And while the consumer at the end of it, the customer at the end of it, is going to define what you stand for as a brand, you've led them there almost subconsciously where they don't even know it. And so it all kind of comes back to that work of really focusing and being purposeful about what you stand for and planning for how consumers will kind of respond to you.
I think it's incredibly important. And it goes back to stressing being singular, being very focused, because yeah, you can get them there and take them on this journey. At many points, they may not even realize they're on the journey, but if you've got multiple rest stops and construction along the way and all of these different obstacles that are screwing up the journey, that's not going to make anybody happy. And they're immediately going to find a much smoother approach to get to the solution and the transformation that they seek. So if you can be focused with what you're doing and have that singular goal in mind, that this is what they're going to get when they reach the end of this journey, I think that's going to serve your brand for years and keep people loyal so they come back time and time again.
Yeah, and it's I think it's commonly known that this is that early brand work you do when you get started, and everybody's in a different phase of their brand journey and growing their brand. But it's something that you always have to come back to. You could be in market for 5 years and not having a whole lot of success, and come back to this purposeful moment of trying to redefine it. Or sometimes like all the trends change and consumers and what used to work no longer works. And so while I think a smart brand will start there and do it right and do it well, and then monitor that and pivot as they need to, it's never too late. And I really think that I would say probably effort and mind space is spent on 80% of like getting your brand out there and getting consumers to react to it, customers to react to it. And less time is spent on this, but it is, I mentioned it before, but it's like amplifies everything else that you do later. So if you're not finding success and you're finding competition, go back there, go back and carve out that niche, and then go back and then on the activation side of doing everything you're doing, if you do it right, you'll see it all amplified and growth in the brand.
Another big part of this is market research. And because everything has been shifting and pivoting over the years, market research has changed as well. Michael, why do you believe that a traditional approach to market research is no longer relevant in today's business landscape?
You're a brand, especially a younger brand, right? They're like, oh, what is branding? What does a brand stand for? You'll go and you'll see the different pillars. You've got your positioning strategy and your brand ethos and your values and all these things that are important, as I've mentioned before, and they can guide you to get to the end point, but so many of them are not at play with the consumer and with your customer. And for all those reasons, everything we've been talking about on this whole podcast so far, limited attention spans, high level of competition. And so putting all this effort down this traditional approach, and then when it actually shows up and what consumers are using to make decisions, not enough focus is spent there. And not enough attention is spent on what really is going on inside their head, what's influencing their decisions for choosing one brand over another, and maybe too much weight on. In fact, actually, I commented on, I kind of threw Pepsi under the bus because this was a LinkedIn post, and they're like, oh, every brand needs a deep story. Like they need a cause. And I was like, no, they don't. Some brands do, but some don't. Whatever brand needs is differentiation. And I feel if Pepsi's saying the only thing that's holding them back from beating Coke, because history has shown how they just got decimated, is that you're not tied to some cause, is that you actually, your product sucks and you're not very well differentiated. And so it goes back to that of like they saying that they need to kind of tack on this brand mission and cause behind the brand is not understanding why consumers are choosing Coke over Pepsi. And so it comes back to that. There's just too much focus, I think, spent on all these things, like a checkbox. I need all these, my brand needs all these pieces. And it almost overshadows what's really driving consumers to make those choices. So the research question, we focus heavily, disproportionately on the consumer. I'm understanding that we don't make choices in a vacuum. We have a lot of things, baggage, if you will, call it, that we bring to the table that is inside their head, that is influencing those decisions. And if you don't approach the research in the right way and understand what those are, then you can't navigate through them.
Well, as we get ready to wind everything down today, Michael, if you could give our audience one piece of brand stimulating advice that they could put into action as soon as they wrap up listening to our conversation today, what would it be?
I'd have every brand go back and kind of think about everything that they talk about their brand and force them to ask this question. If I could only say one thing about my brand ever again, what would it be? And how can I make it better and get more singular on this one statement? Because consumers, they just can't remember too many things. So what is that one thing that you want to be known for and really get it right?
Well, Michael, I want to thank you for bringing the goods to Evolution of Brand with you today. Tell us how EOB Mafia can connect with you for even more value and discover what you're up to over at Smash Brand.
Sure. So I think the social media side of things, I'm on LinkedIn. That's the place where if I'm going to publish some things or kind of comment on things or connect with me. But we do write a fair amount, and that can be found on smashbrand.com on our article site.
Well, I will put links to those in the show notes as always, and I'll be following you on LinkedIn because I want to see you call out Pepsi some more. I'm a Coke.
All right.
So, Michael, before we get out of here, if you could go back in time and share one thing with your pre-evolved self that would completely change the game for you today, what would it be?
I would stop over-engineering things. I'm much better about it now, but just from my background, it goes back to the simplicity, right? Be more simple.
K-I-S-S, as they say.
Keep it simple, stupid.
That's right. Michael, once again, thank you very much for joining me here on Evolution of Brand today.
It's been great. Thanks for having me on, Jason.
As we continue to move forward, EOB Mafia, there's no doubt more brands are going to emerge and advertising channels are going to get noisier. Are you ready for it? Is your brand going to stand out? Take Michael's advice to heart. Make sure you're set up to enhance your visibility and that you're ready to provide the best experience possible for your customers. I'd like to once again thank Michael Keplinger for bringing so much value to Evolution of Brand today. To get more from this episode, visit evolutionofbrand.com, click on the archives link, then go to episode 139. Or head straight to jasoncircone.com/Michael Keplinger for instant access to links, resources, and show notes. And I'm talking primo notes. I got an A. Want to support Evolution of Brand? Subscribe, follow, rate, and review. It's all appreciated. But above all else, recommend this episode of Evolution of Brand to one person in your circle who you know will be impacted by what they hear. And with that, episode 139 of Evolution of Brand is in the history books. I want to thank you for taking the time to listen today, and I look forward to reconvening with you once again when episode 140 goes live. Until then, jump back in the archives and check out some of the great conversations that have taken place right here on Evolution of Brand. Until our paths cross again, this is Jason Sircone reminding you to never stop evolving.